It's really great to see people here. As we acknowledge this morning, we're on Gadigal land, and I think it's important to acknowledge Gadigal people and all Aboriginal people for the thousands of years of care for the land that we enjoy, but also for the resistance to colonisation that's come for more than 200 years now, resistance to the destructive and exploitative system that's destroying the environment of this continent and that drove a genocide of Indigenous people that's got so many parallels with the genocidal process that we're currently seeing play out in Gaza. And the talk today is very much coming in the spirit of solidarity that has been expressed between the movement for black rights in this country, the Indigenous rights struggle, and the movement for Palestinian justice. Very, very deep connections of solidarity over many generations. People have built a joint struggle against settler colonialism, against systems of settler colonialism, a particular way of organising society that has driven the genocide of Indigenous peoples here and around the world. And we're going to talk about the phenomenon of settler colonialism, its role more broadly in the system of global capitalism and imperialism. Because while I think a lot of the connections that have been drawn are very, very powerful and very, very important between the experiences in Palestine and the experiences here on Aboriginal lands, there are also some really key differences in the way that the different pattern of settler colonialism actually played out through the formation of Australia, the ongoing operations of the Australian state and Australian imperialism, and what we actually see in Israel. And understanding those differences, as well as understanding the similarities, I think is very important when we're talking about strategy for struggle, how we actually confront the horrors that both regimes perpetrate, how we actually push them back, and how ultimately, as we want, a revolution that can actually overthrow, the systems that have oppressed Indigenous people around the world for so very long, along with destroying the planet that all of us rely on. So in terms of what is settler colonialism, it's important, I think, to distinguish settler colonialism from other forms of colonialism that were both part of the drive to divide the world up by European powers that, had been running for a couple of hundred years and then really intensified sort of in the 19th century. If you want to look back at some of the early Marxist writings about this phenomenon, you can see in the Second International, for example, in the early 20th century, Marxist theorists would draw a distinction between exploitation colonies, they called, such as India, for example, a prime example, places where the colonising population was very, very small. It involved the military forces, an administrative layer, maybe some, sort of other civilian population, but for the most part, the colonising force was a very small minority of the broader population. The broader population remained the Indigenous population, actually, of those lands. And it was the aim of the colony to extract as much wealth as possible from those lands by both exploiting the labour of native people, but also extracting resources, to benefit the mother country, to benefit the imperialist country that actually held the colony. That's distinguished from work colonies or settlement colonies, where actually part of the process of colonisation and domination of the region involves a degree of an attempt to actually replace, like committing a genocide against the Indigenous people who were there and replacing those people with often European sort of people who are actually coming in who make up the bulk of the workforce then. So it is a process of actual replacement of the people who are in that particular geographic area with settlers. But, for the interests, again, the particular interests of the imperialist country, of the mother country. And there's been a lot of a proliferation of study of settler colonialism and the phenomenon of settler colonialism within the academy, particularly over the last 20 years or so. It's been quite a fashionable school of settler colonial studies. People may be aware of the work of Patrick Wolfe, who's passed away a couple of years ago, but was a world-leading historian, Australian-based historian and theorist, who started to theorise settler colonialism and would often describe settler colonialism as being driven by a logic of elimination. The aim of a settler colony is to replace the Indigenous population. That means it has built into it some logic which is going to lead to either the extermination, the replacement, or the forced assimilation of those Indigenous people. I think, there's a lot in Patrick Wolfe's analysis, there's a lot we can draw, there's absolutely no doubt that there's genocidal dynamics in all settler colonies, horrific genocidal practices practiced by settler colonies, but I think it's quite misleading to actually consider a settler colony as somehow being driven by a logic that somehow a will to settle is sort of the way that you get it in the theory. There's something in a settler colony where the settlers just want to take over the land, have to take over the land, have to annihilate the indigenous people to do it. That's the sort of the will of the settler is the logic that's actually driving the destructive process. And I think for Marxists, it's not particularly satisfying, this explanation, actually. There's all different models of settler colonialism, different patterns of genocide, different patterns of oppression, but behind them, the logic is always the logic actually of capital accumulation is what actually structures the division of the world, you know, and the process of, you know, the expansion of capitalism around the world that drove the creation of settler colonies, you know, but also the particular dynamics that govern the actual operation, though, you know, sort of those colonies. Very much there's the logic of capital accumulation, the need to expand and expand, you know, the profit-making system, bring more profits in for capitalism is what drives an expansion. But there's also another logic that's part of capital accumulation, which is the logic of imperialism. And this is the logic, you know, particularly as we saw in the 19th century, but even before that, you saw the need for capital to actually organise itself into national blocks if it's going to be able to compete on a global scale, and for it to be able to use the force of an imperialist government to enforce the will of the particular capitalist class which exists within that sort of imperialist country to enforce their will globally, to ensure their access to raw materials, to markets, to keeping rivals out. You know, this is a process of imperialism that actually becomes necessary to maintain a regime of capital accumulation as capitalism centralises and grows. And as those two logics, I think, are the most important ones to look at when we want to actually look at any particular settler colony and its dynamics, is the logics of capital accumulation and the logics of imperialism. And we can see that it's the logic of imperialism that actually drives the creation of both the colonies in Australia and the creation of Israel. In the Australian context, the British, in the first instance, were actually very worried about the French getting their foothold in, you know, into this particular area. So they rushed to establish a colony at Botany Bay. Actually, in the early years, when they first set up the colony in Sydney, there were French ships around the harbour at what's now called La Perouse. There were other European powers that were scouting the area, and this was the early stages by which the different European countries were carving up the world amongst them. And they rushed to ensure that the Australian continent would be a continent where British imperialism would have the foothold. As I'll go on to describe, you know, actually there was a lot done to actually try to subsidise the process of settlement, make the process attractive to ordinary people to actually be able to come out here and settle. I mean, obviously there was the penal colony where people were forcibly brought here, but there was a lot done to try to actually populate the continent with British stock, with British people, in a way that actually would secure the region for the interests of British imperialism. In Israel, it's a bit of a different situation. You actually had a Zionist movement which was trying to sell itself to different imperialist powers as being able to prosecute their interests in the Middle East if they would, you know, sort of support the Zionists to actually set up a, you know, to set up a settler colony. So Herzl is one of the early theorists and, you know, sort of proponents of Zionism. He says that for Europe, we would constitute a bulwark against Asia down there. We would be the advanced post of civilization against barbarism. So this is what the Zionists were actually saying at the time, you know, support us and we'll be the spearhead, the bulwark against this uncivilized sort of Asian region. But quite specifically, there was an appeal to the British, and you got the Balfour Declaration during the First World War, where the British saw, if we actually support a Jewish homeland in Palestine and facilitate a process of emigration of Jewish people and settlement into Palestine, this will give us some kind of bargaining chip and some kind of more stake in the debate that was happening after the First World War about how that region would be divided up. They were worried about France getting the mandate. France, you know, had historical connections to the region. The British actually supporting the creation of a Jewish national homeland there gave them a bit of a foothold to be able to actually take on the mandate in Palestine after the First World War, take it off the Ottoman Empire and actually establish British control sort of historic Palestine at that time. And it's under the British Protectorate. It's not like Australia, where the mother country, Britain, actually populates the settler colony. It's Jewish people from across Europe that are sent to populate the settler colony. But England becomes the mother country in this sense, in terms of it provides the actual cover, the imperialist cover, you know, for allowing that immigration and defending sort of the immigration of the Jewish settler colonists. There's also an important development that you see within settler colonialism, which is once you get the establishment of the settler colony, you actually actually get the emergence of a distinct set of interests amongst the new ruling class that establishes itself in that settler colony. And that new settler colony, even though it knows that it requires the support of the major imperialist power to actually continue to operate, also is always trying to push for more support, more aggression, more ability to actually back up the interests of the new ruling class that's developing in the settler colony. And Maxine Rodinson is a Jewish academic, actually, who wrote a classic pamphlet, Israel, a Settler Colonial State, talking about analysing Israel as a settler colonial state. He talks about the uprising against the British that was actually launched by the Zionists after the White Paper in 1939, where it looked like the British may not support the creation actually of a particular Jewish state. He says that this was part of a classic pattern where tensions arise between the mother country and the colony about their specific interests in the region. And you've got a rebellion by Zionists actually against the British, fighting hard to actually force not just the British, but then the United Nations and Western imperialism as a whole to actually support the establishment of a Jewish state in 1848 with the partition plan. But then going far further than the European imperialists actually wanted them to at that time, and launching their own war against the Arab population, establishing the Zionist state, establishing, you know, its territorial basis on the basis of genocide and dispossession, knowing that they actually had the support of the Europeans, even though the Europeans weren't, you know, European powers weren't supporting them as far as they could go. This actually isn't that, this isn't that unique in the history of settler colonies. You want to look at actually the creation of the United States of America out of the US Revolution, in many ways was a new settler colonial ruling class and the colonies on the eastern side of the United States rebelling against the British who had facilitated the settlement and the genocide on the east coast of the United States, because the British were actually holding back the interests of the newly forming American ruling class. They had deals with other powers, the French, the Spanish, other indigenous tribes. They had rules against the expansion westward actually for the colonies that made up the initial United States, and a big part of the initial American Revolution was throwing off that fetter, and so the United States could consolidate its own power and drive its own imperialist interests, its own westward expansion sort of across the continental United States, across the Caribbean and more broadly. So not a progressive revolution in that sense. You've got a rebellion against being actually held back, you know, as an imperialist power in their own right. You also see the same thing actually in Australia. So I think it's 1881 or 1882, Queensland, you know, the settler colony of Queensland, which committed frightful genocide across the Queensland frontier, expanded right across, you know, actually went up and planted the Union Jack in New Guinea, right, in Port Moresby, planted the Union Jack and claimed Papua New Guinea for the British, right, and for the new Queensland settler colony. And then the British turned around and said, what the hell do you think you're doing? Right, you're actually disrupting the relationships that we have with the Germans, who already had colonial possessions there. It was far more important for the British to have a stable pattern of relations with German imperialism than it was for these upstarts, you know, in the Queensland colony to be able to get more land. So you can see there's the tension. It was actually out of the process of Britain denying Queensland Papua New Guinea that they decided we actually need to get far more organised as a national bourgeoisie, as a national Australian bourgeoisie. It was part of the impetus to actually creating the Australian state as an independent state that would be able to stand on its own two feet and prosecute its own imperialist interests in the region. So this is, you know, this is quite, you know, this is a very important phenomenon. The development of a sub-imperialist power that's in many ways an ultra-imperialism, because they're, you know, carrying out, very vigorously prosecuting the ability to try to dominate the region and secure their own interests, always looking over their shoulder and trying to drag the other imperialist powers far more into the area to be backing up what they're doing. Okay, you can see a bifurcation, though, a bit of a split, you know, throughout the 20th century in terms of the actual nature of these settler colonies that have been established through the 19th century and into the 20th century in terms of their nature. And there's a lot of different kinds of settler colonies you could talk about, but I just want to talk sort of for the rest of the talk, I think, two broad categories that are important to consider. On the first hand, you have what I think you can call the Anglosphere settler colonies, and I'll talk specifically about the United United States, Canada and Australia in this instance, you know, where actually by the 20th century, by the early 20th century, the ruling class and the capitalist class in these countries enjoys domination of the entire continent, right? So they've actually managed to take the entire continent by force of arms. There's no longer a military struggle against the indigenous people who are dispossessed, and there's also not a hot war on their border with other countries and other populations that are around. So the intensity of the settler colonial violence that's actually built into the system subsides because, you know, the area, the territory has actually been secured in that sense, in a military sense, and there's no hot war on the border. And the indigenous population in both of those countries ends up being like quite a very small percentage of the population. Horrifically oppressed, you know, terrible racism directed against them, but not the open warfare, you know, that there had been previously. In Africa, the situation is actually quite different. You've got South Africa as a white settler colony, you've got Algeria as a French settler colony, you've got Israel established as a general European settler colony. In all of those examples, actually, there continues to be a hot war, right? You've still got a situation where there's very, very fierce resistance, including military resistance, from the actual indigenous peoples actually in the area, and there's no chance of peace on the border. You have, you know, constant resistance, constant rebellion, anti-colonial fighting. And in both of these situations, the working class in these countries that belongs to the coloniser population, the French in Algeria, the whites in South Africa, they don't act in a way that we look at the normal working class when we're looking at a prospect of social revolutionary transformation. They don't act in that way, right? They act in a way that's actually fundamentally compromised. They're tied very closely, actually, to the settler colonial regime in various ways. They're tied with privileges. They've got far more income than the native workers that are actually there, enjoy some of the fruits of the exploitation of the native workers. But also, you've got a very, very hot clash and a hot military conflict where they feel that their actual identity, sort of as the white working class in South Africa or as the French Algerians, there's an existential question about whether they'll actually continue to exist in that way if there's a revolution and if the regime is overthrown. And the same is true in Israel. And I'll go on to describe the extent to which you've got a situation where we don't look to the Israeli working class as being a force for social transformation as the way Marxists generally look to the working class as the force of social transformation across most of the world, precisely because of the nature of settlement, precisely because of the nature of the genocide and the role that the working class in Israel has played in that. It's different, I think, from Australia and the other Anglosphere settler colonies, where you've got the development of capitalism, antagonism between the working class and the capitalist class. The actual settler colonial conflict is not something that's in front of people day to day as a major contradiction that actually influences their life in any real way, and you get the prospect for the development of class struggle that can actually act in solidarity with the colonised people, in solidarity with the indigenous people against the state, in a way that we don't see in Israel. So I'll go on to describe that and talk about some of that process. But firstly, I did want to just touch on a couple of the commonalities, I think, since October the 7th that have really struck me about the colonisation of Australia and what we're actually seeing in Europe. I think it is powerful, these connections that have been drawn, and they are worth reflecting on. The first one is the extent to which I've done a lot of study of the frontier wars in Australia, and it's something that's really extraordinary to see. The rhetoric in the wake of the Hamas attacks on October 7 was exactly what you saw in Australian newspapers in like 1830, 1835 about the outrages of the natives, right? Like, this is exactly, there's an attack by Aboriginal people on a farm settlement. Maybe they have killed the whole family. Actually, maybe they've gone in and killed, you know, the women and children who are in the hut as well as the men, because there's a general war on the settler population that's actually coming from the indigenous resistance, that actually comes out of the situation that people have found themselves in. They're being destroyed, their whole families have been killed, they recognise it's an existential crisis, and they attack the settlement as a whole, right? And then that is used as a pretext for genocidal massacres, right? They say, look at these deprived natives. How terrible. How could they possibly do this? They are so deprived, they are so backward, we have to go out and kill them all, right? Like, that is the response. And I think it's important thing to actually look at is that, and Stephen Gapps has done a study of the massacres in Wiradjuri country, the Wiradjuri War, that ran from about 1821 to 1825, and he's very, very clear. This was not just a series of massacres, far from it. It was a period of all-out resistance warfare that was only put down by massacres. And I think that's actually quite important. The massacres that we're seeing in Gaza at the moment, they are about Hamas. They are about the fact that there has been considerable consistent resistance from the population in Gaza. And for Israel, that resistance is existential. And what's their solution? Completely wipe out the entire population. Right, that's the solution. Massacres en masse as a counter-insurgency strategy. You saw it in Australia on the frontier. You're seeing it in Israel today. The other thing that I thought that I've found quite striking in the parallels is the war that Israel is raging on UNRWA, on the refugee support agency that exists in Palestine. One of the main reasons they want to destroy UNRWA is because of the memory that UNRWA holds and continues to keep alive about all of those refugee families having property in Israel. Right? UNRWA actually keeps a register of all of the lands and houses that Palestinians that were expelled from, right? And the families and what their entitlements are actually with a return to those places, and keep alive the idea that Palestinians in Gaza, who maybe three or four generations ago, their families were dispossessed somewhere else in historic Palestine, that they actually have a right of return, right? So Israel wants to destroy UNRWA, to destroy the memory and destroy the idea that people have a claim on lands within historic Palestine. And my mind just goes straight to the rotten native title system we have in this country, right? With a native title system, which is in response to resistance that's come from Indigenous peoples over many generations, get some small recognition that you have to rights to land within the system, but unless you can prove an ongoing connection to the particular piece of land you're trying to claim under native title, you have no claim under native title. And the Australian government will stand up in court and argue that the tide of history has washed away this connection because, look, in the past we actually rounded these people up and took them on trucks to all different areas, so they haven't been able to maintain a connection to that area, so they shouldn't be considered traditional owners anymore. So you can see there's both Israel and Australia, you have an ongoing war on the memory of Indigenous occupation to try and legitimise the claims of the settler colonial state actually over the territory. But we do have the important differences, I think, that are important to talk about going forward. The first is, as I said before, the development of a working class in the Anglosphere settler colonies that has developed some practice and certainly a potential and a possibility of solidarity with Indigenous struggle and solidarity with anti-imperialist struggle in a way that's not possible in Israel. So the first thing to say is that the actual expansion of the frontier in Australia, unlike in Israel, where I think it's very strictly been driven by the particular needs of imperialism and the military aspect of the conflict, in Australia it was driven by capital accumulation. Right? So blatantly what was happening throughout the 19th century was huge tracts of land were being given to major agricultural companies who would take those leases, flood the land with stock, and kill all the Aboriginal people that actually got in the way of the expansion of pastoral capitalism across the frontier. So in the example of the Wiradjuri that I mentioned before, between 1821 and 1825 was the period where the New South Wales government at the time, the colonial administration, under pressure from major pastoralists, including a new joint stock company called the Australian Agricultural Company, which was raising millions of pounds in Britain for expansion into Australia, they were under pressure to release new lands over the Blue Mountains for, as Stephen Gapp said, the unfettered march of large capital across the Blue Mountains, right? So this was the period in which they said, OK, we will open up these lands to colonisation. And they were opened up, and that's when you got the frightful massacres and the flood of stock actually into those areas. So the expansion of the frontier in Australia wasn't driven by an organic process of settlement by ordinary people, like convicts going out and saying, oh, I want this land or I want that land and fighting with Indigenous people. It was driven by capitalism. It was driven by the expansion of capitalism right across the continent. That's not to say that actually the British were very interested in tying the labouring classes to the settler colonial project in a very material way. So there were land grants given to convicts. There were land grants given to free settlers. It was a way of actually saying, you're part of the colonising society, the superior society, you're going to get something out of this if you stick along with us. A lot of people did get land. I mean, my family was given land as part of this process, the settlement process, you know, in the 1860s in northern New South Wales, after going there as cedar cutters. They went there as workers to cut, you know, cut trees down, and then had an opportunity to get some land, had it for a little while, lost it with the market, you know, and what actually happens with capitalism. But that was the way that it was done, to actually try to tie non-Indigenous people into the project, to think that I can advance myself in Australia, and I should actually get my family to come out to Australia because I can get some land. Marx actually analysed this process in Capital Volume 1, in Chapter 33. He talked about how the dynamics in the settler colony were fundamentally different in terms of the creation of a proletariat than the dynamics actually back in England and Europe and in the other areas he was studying. studying, precisely because in the areas he's studying, like in England, the industrial proletariat has been created by a clearance of the countryside, an enclosure of the collective lands, pushing people into the cities where they have to work, whereas in the settler colony, a worker can go out on the frontier and find some land. Right? And then someone following them can find some land, and someone following them can find some land. And this fundamentally shaped working class politics, particularly in the United States, for the time that Marx was writing. Right? So workers' organisations, so unions that were forming in the US in the mid-19th century, were lobbying very hard for the opening up of Indian lands for settlement by workers, right? This was actually part, there was an antagonism between the emerging workers' movement and Indigenous peoples who still held onto land. And Lincoln did. Lincoln, with the support of a lot of workers, including Marxists at the time, who were part of the Republican Party, who had the slogan, free soil, free land, right? Free labour. Like, that was their slogan. Lincoln got elected on the basis of the Homestead Act, that he actually opened up a whole lot of what was then Indian territory and handed over to settler workers. The point that Marx was making was, this process is going to end. The land will run out, right? You can't hide from capitalism by running away to the frontier. Eventually the frontier will close, and Engels actually wrote in the 1880s, we're seeing the end of the great safety valve that had stopped the creation of a proletariat in the United States by the closure of the frontier in this time. And you actually saw that there were joint interests between Indigenous people at this time in the United States and the workers, who the workers' movement was starting to be an insurgent workers' movement. So there's examples in the 1870s where in places like Chicago and Kansas, workers held insurrectionary strikes, actually starting to fight the police, etc. And you had the redeployment of US Army from the frontier fighting the Sioux and the Lakota and other places to smash the workers' uprisings in the cities. So you can see how there would have been a chance for solidarity, but at that time the politics hadn't developed. Where you got a breakthrough in terms of the politics about the need for the working class to support anti-colonial and anti-imperialist struggle was with the development of the Communist International and the Russian Revolution, right? And that's when you actually get an articulation of the principles that are very important for us and are very important for all the anti-imperialist movements that we've been part of, which say that the working class in an imperialist country has an interest in fighting with, alongside and in solidarity with, a national liberation struggle that's fighting against your own ruling class. Right? If they're fighting against colonial control in the colonies, we have to back them 100%, because it's the same ruling class that's got the throat on their neck, that's got the boot on their neck, that's got the boot on our neck. Right? And if they can defeat in the colonies, we're going to be actually stronger here. Part and parcel of that was the need to challenge and break the racism that was actually in the heads of most workers, which bound them to their own government, to say, I actually stand with the colonised people that are fighting back. And you started to see that kind of politics become possible in Australia, the United States and other people, in solidarity with Indigenous people, once the frontier had closed, once there was never this process of actually giving land, no longer actually works as a safety valve, and where you start getting an anti-war, anti-racist pole emerge within the industrial working class. And this becomes very important in the Australian context if you want to think about the Indigenous struggle. Right? So in 1933, there's actually the Communist Party at this time had taken a position in solidarity with Indigenous people. Right? They'd come out and said, we need to fight to return land, to break up the racist protection boards that were controlling Aboriginal life, etc. We've got to fight them. There was a mobilisation of workers' organisations, big public meetings, you know, meetings at the docks, opposing an attempted massacre of Yolngu people in Arnhem Land in 1933. It was the last attempt that the government in Australia had of a public massacre, sending out police to massacre Aboriginal people, was actually stopped by a mobilisation of trade unionists, of radical workers, a minority of radical workers. But I think this shows what was possible. I mean, I've got plenty of examples here then through the 20th century of the way that workers in Australia, a minority of workers but an important minority, have actually stood with Aboriginal people to show that that solidarity is possible, that we have a joint struggle against our rulers. Now, that has never happened in Israel, right? It just doesn't happen. You don't have a situation where trade unions in Israel take a stand against anti-Palestinian racism. I mean, you can be very critical of the Australian labour movement, the extent to which they've, you know, consistently fought for black rights, consistently challenged racism. We have to deal all the time with pushing our union officials to actually take these issues seriously in circumstances where they don't want to take them seriously, right? Just like they don't want to take our wage struggle seriously, they don't want to take a struggle against racism seriously. They've got to be fought to do it. But it is possible to do it. You never see it in Israel. And the reason why you never see it in Israel is because of the nature of the Israeli working class. And I don't have an enormous amount of time. I probably actually have gone over time, but just the small little bit of time that I do have left, I'll give some account of that. I think the first thing to say is that the actual organisation of the ethnic cleansing was led by workers' organisations in historic Palestine, was led by workers' organisations in Israel. So the Histadrut, the trade union that wasn't just a trade union, is far more broadly actually becomes like a collective, you know, sort of economic actor that can bring together business and the state and the unions, right, the creation of the Israeli Labour Party. It's from the ranks of these, you know, of these people that you actually get the most vicious repression and ethnic cleansing, you know, in 1848, actually in the, you know, in the beginning of the Nakba. And the Histadrut actually plays a big role. You don't have a Zionist capitalist class. It's not that it's profitable to expand in Palestine, and that's why the Zionists are in Palestine. They're trying to create their own state, and they're trying to do it and so they can actually have the backing of Western imperialism. And so they fight very hard. The whole reason for being of the actual Histadrut and of these labour organisations is to exclude Palestinians from the territory that they're operating in, exclude Palestinians from the work that they're actually doing, and create a Jewish homeland sort of in that regard. That's led by the labour organisations, and it's subsidised. I think that's the important thing. It's not a situation where they're just being exploited by Zionist bosses, and so you can get in there and, you know, get into that antagonism and start to agitate for revolutionary action. Actually, the reason why they've got jobs and they've got houses, they've stolen Palestinian houses to house the workers, and the reason why they've even got economic activity is because of the subsidies that are coming in from World Zionist organisations, from the reparations that were paid after the Second World War and the Holocaust by West Germany, by military subsidies, by subsidies from the United States over many, many years. So the actual creation of the working class is one that happens within the cocoon of the Zionist settler state, and it's one that's directly subsidised actually by the West, which allows them to grow. So you don't have this, and the main contradiction that faces people day to day is actually the war with Palestine. Right, it's not the fight with their own bosses. That's what dominates politics, that will dominate consciousness. And the important thing, also very important thing in there, is the extent to which Israel itself becomes essentially a garrison society. So unlike in Australia or the United States, where the actual question of military struggle is not something that is part of people's lives, mostly. In Israel, you're all in the military, right? The military is everything. It's the dominant institution. It's what's responsible for your housing. It's what's responsible for your healthcare. What's responsible for your education. People have got active experience going out. The racist repression that's actually meted out to people in the West Bank and Gaza is something that's a collective experience that the Israelis actually perpetrate on the Palestinians because of the extent to which people are conscripted within the military. And even when in the 1980s and 1990s you've had a fall away of the extent to which Israel is directly subsidised, the Israeli economy is directly subsidised in that sense, what you have seen is the massive growth of the arms economy, where Israel is now per capita the biggest arms exporter in the world, right? They play this crucial role, the high-tech industries, in terms of keeping the wages higher in Israel and this sort of thing. It all comes out of the military industry that they're all involved in, along with the actual military conflict that they're all involved in. And in these circumstances, it's not the case that we can actually see a break where you can get in and split the Zionist workers off from the Zionist bosses and unite with the struggle across Palestine. In these circumstances, we don't actually look to the working class inside Israel, we look to the working class across the region. Right, it's the working class across the region that can isolate Israel, that could blockade all supplies going to Israel, that could blockade any military actually going to Israel, that could create a revolutionary crisis, that can actually smash the Zionist state. And it's only in the context of a revolutionary movement growing that could possibly smash the Zionist state that you could see the possibility of any breaks within Israeli society. So that's the last thing that I'll finish on is the question of colonisation here as well. Because I think that, you know, what we have seen and what we continue to try to build is whether it's fighting, you know, for justice in Palestine, fighting against our own rulers and their own militarism and imperialism that bolsters the occupation of Palestine, fighting against the horrific oppression that Indigenous people continue to experience. It's not the case anymore that workers are saying the state can say, oh, I'm going to clear this land and give you a house, you know, clear the Aboriginal people out and we'll give you this house and keep the worker on side. That's not the case anymore. That doesn't mean the horrific of oppression of the Indigenous people isn't just as fierce as it was 50, 60 years ago when you had a protection board. In the police in New South Wales, the majority of the kids police go after in New South Wales are black kids. The child protection system in New South Wales, the majority of the kids they go out and take are Aboriginal kids, right? Why is that? It's because of the intense hostility to Indigenous people and Indigenous interests that's actually built into the state in this country. The way that it's developed, the whole justification for the establishment and set-up of Australia relies on the dehumanisation of Indigenous people now in a way it did then. And that has really serious ideological implications. That means racism, which is the lifeblood of our ruling class, is also the lifeblood of the dominant ideology and is very strong right across society. So any time we can actually break workers with that and bring them to supporting Indigenous struggle, as we have done. I mean, we've helped to win trade union opposition to gas mining in the Pilliga Forest in solidarity with the Gomeroi people who've said they do not want gas mining in the Pilliga Forest. If we want to fight anti-Aboriginal racism, we need to build the power of our workers' organisations to say, when Aboriginal people say what they want on their land, we've got a power to deliver it. That's how we can actually challenge the colonial dynamic. That's how we can challenge, you know, sort of the ongoing oppression, is building up a joint struggle to say, we can actually fight to return Aboriginal land as a way of building power to our side and also putting our in a position where we can take on the militarism of the Albanese government, their ongoing imperialism in our region, their ongoing support for the genocide in Gaza, break the imperialist system and open the door for a socialist future. Thank you.